little sight on the info highway. Little show like the one before. Little films with so much to speak of. I can't wait to say.
Bonjour! Bonjour!
Bonjour! Bonjour! Here comes the podcast. This is Steve, like always. This week we chat with Derek Wong. We talk Beauty and the Beast. It's an animated feast. If you're lucky, this will be the only song.
Steve, what are you doing?
Nothing. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish.
Welcome to the podcast. We are very excited this week to talk about Bill Condon's remake of Disney's iconic animated film Beauty and the Beast. As we talk about this, I'm very excited to have Screenfish newbie and the beauty to my beast, Derek Wong. Welcome, Derek.
Thank you, Steve.
This week we are talking about Disney's remake of Beauty and the Beast, which made every dollar in the box office last weekend. It continues on their live-action remakes of their own animated properties, which I assume will go on for years and years to come. But fun fact I read this week, they have only been ordered by Disney to be hands-off anything past 2000.
Very interesting.
I did not know that, but that makes sense. This Beauty and the Beast, of course, tells the story of Belle, a young French peasant whose father is held captive by a beast in a castle, and she gives her life for his. And there are many songs and dancing teacups. And before we get into the conversation, though, Derek, I should remind our audience that spoilers are totally open for conversation.
There's going to be spoilers?
There will be spoilers.
No way!
So, Beauty and the Beast, what did you think?
Well, Steve, to tell you honestly, my wife and I, when we went to watch it, seeing all the trailers, knowing how big this movie was for us when we were younger, we were very excited. Like, super duper excited. And having Emma Watson as lead role, thought, you know what? She's an actress. She can handle all those duties. It looked great. It looked great. And in a nutshell, if you're there to see the visuals will just astound you. Hmm. However, which is the sad part, I would say, is my wife and I found the movie underwhelming. That, unfortunately, the special effects and the visuals and the costumes took precedence for Disney, which may explain why I had like a budget of $160 million, I believe it was.
Yeah.
So $160 million, I understand, because when you see the movie, it is gorgeous. It is a gorgeous movie. But I feel it was at the cost of telling a story which I felt connected to the characters. Hmm. That's how I felt. How did you feel about it?
My experience with Beauty and the Beast is a little different in that I love the film.
Right.
I do love the film, but when it came out, I was just at that age where it wasn't cool to like the Disney princess stuff, you know? So I was sort of hands-off it for a few years.
I understand.
Now I have a deep love for it.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny, when Alicia and I went and saw it, she was all ready for, you know, when they're going to dance in the ballroom.
Oh my gosh,
and
was
all that stuff. And I leaned over to her after they sang Gaston, and I said, that's my favorite song, and the next song is Kill the Beast. And she said, why are those your favorite? I said, because I was a 13-year-old boy when it came out. And that just, those are the numbers that really stuck with me. And you're right on the visuals. They nailed the visuals. I'll tell you that what I find interesting is that as they continue to remake their live-action properties and make money hand over fist, and they are making money hand over fist.
Oh, they are raking in those greenbacks. Let me tell you, just tons and tons of cash. I mean, $170 million in one weekend? That's domestically.
Yeah.
That's crazy talk.
It's something like $400 already.
Oh my gosh.
Worldwide.
That's insane.
And there's already talk about that it's easily going across $1 billion.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff like that.
No doubt.
But when I was considering the film, one of the things I thought of is they cannot screw up Beauty and the Beast. And I don't mean they're unable to. I mean they absolutely have to go out of their way to hit it as a home run. Because still, there are, of all the Disney properties, there are two that have become virtually sacred. There's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Absolutely.
And Beauty and the Beast, which is still the only film
Nominated for best Oscar.
Yep, best picture. The only animated film at all. Not only the only animated Disney film, the only animated film ever nominated for best picture. So this one, they needed to pull out the big guns. Now, they're using star power for their other ones, but like Jungle Book, you can change Jungle Book however you want, because people really only remember about 20 minutes of Jungle Book anyway.
Right.
So, but this one was actually, I think, a substantial risk. The other risk, I would say, would be Aladdin, and that's because of Robin Williams.
Mm-hmm.
But the film itself, if you make adjustments to it, people probably only remember half of it anyways,
right,
other than Robin Williams. Little Mermaid, again, held up iconically. But Beauty and the Beast is the gold standard. And I'll admit, I liked it. I liked it a lot. Personally, I did like it. I thought it dragged in a few places because they added about 40 minutes.
Right.
So there was some unnecessary stuff. I'm hearing that it's getting a mediocre score on Rotten Tomatoes, but a high audience score. I think in Rotten Tomatoes it's currently sitting at 70, but the audience score is sitting around 85.
Yeah, I can see that.
Which is fascinating to me. Some have said it improves on the original in every way. I don't feel that way, but I do feel like if they made the original today, any of the quote-unquote changes
right
would simply be in there.
Yeah.
It's because we had an 88-minute movie that clicks along, and we now have a 130-minute movie.
It's a long movie. It was. I guess, like, for me, when I watched it, and it's interesting because after the movie, my wife and I looked at some YouTube videos comparing just some clips to the movies. And one thing that I think was significant is when you are using animation as a storytelling device, you get to emphasize or overemphasize facial expressions. So, I mean, if something is shocked, your eyes are not just like normal eye size. It could be double the size. So it looks more dramatic.
Yeah.
Or sometimes I still remember the moment where, spoiler, when the Beast comes to get Belle for the first time for dinner and she refused to come down. In the anime movie, he's hammering that door. Like,
yeah,
he's killing the door. And the I can't remember who the actor who played the voices in the original anime movie, but his voice was scary. It was scary.
Yeah,
and
it's true.
And when I talked with my wife and I said, it didn't seem that same. I mean, it had, in the movie, the Beast's voice was angry, but it didn't have a sense of dread. And it was almost like they had to tone down, because if you had a monster, visually, a real monster,
well,
and showing,
they had to
do that. But for me, for Andre and myself, we were looking at it going, what's missing this movie? And I think it's just because we were so accustomed to the animation of, I guess, a hyper-realized telling of the story with animation, that watching this, it seemed a little flat.
I actually thought Dan Stevens did a good job. There were things I knew had to happen, and one of them was that the Beast cannot be as terrifying as he was in the animated film. It was interesting. Alicia and I were talking. She was talking to her sister about could she recommend the film to a younger kid. And she said, which would you find scarier, this one or the Jungle Book remake? And I said, Jungle Book.
Oh, absolutely.
Hands down. And I think that it was more necessary for that one than this one, because Shere Khan in The Jungle Book is the epitome of evil.
Oh, he was terrible. And I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it because
Idris Elba, like, killed
him.
But Dan Stevens has to be somewhat likable. He has to be scary but broken. I thought that she did an excellent job. I thought her singing improved as the film went on. I thought that the first couple of tracks, it was sort of like adjusting.
I think that was one of my criticisms, and it's like, it's whether it be justified or not, but when you watch the anime movie, the first scene when Belle comes into the village, that song is like kind of like, little town, it's a quiet village, and it's huge, right? I mean, and the coordination of pretty much whoever did the editing of the singing in that movie, the pacing was excellent, whereas this one, it was more a slower development of characters. And I felt like the pacing, the pulses were a little slower, and for me, that's like, oh no, that's not good for me, because in the original anime movie, it sets its tone off, it's going to be a big movie, where this one was like, it's going to be a movie, kind of big, but we're kind of getting to know the village.
I noticed, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was one of the things I felt about this one, is it took its time.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it gets interesting, because how much of our enjoyment of the film is tied into our nostalgia of the other?
Oh, yeah.
And let's be serious. That's why it made money hand over fist. It's because of the nostalgia. Now, at the same time, it carries with it expectations. But with the original film clocking in at 88 minutes, those songs had to be boom, 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 boom. They had to be moving along at a certain pace. And with this one, they gave themselves the opportunity to take their time. Like Gaston, which is still my favorite song, there was, like, I would say a dance break, but it isn't really a dance break, but the sword fight break, and there's sort of a... And for somebody who knows the song as well as I do, I had certain expectations of how it was going to run.
Right.
And I thought the number went fine, but in some ways it can also be a hindrance, because even though the number goes fine, you're sitting there and you're saying, well, that's not how I remember it.
Right. Right.
So there is that challenge. Do I think that she has become the iconic Belle? No.
Oh,
This has replaced the original?
No.
No, I don't. But I think my enjoyment was higher, and I thought that the performances and the people they brought in were A-listers.
Oh, yeah.
To an extent that they haven't done. And I think Jungle Book brought in A-listers, sure. But, like, they spared no expense and pulled out all the stops with their cast on this film. For me, I left the theater happy. I left the theater happy.
I left the film dissatisfied, actually. I felt...
You were dissatisfied.
I was dissatisfied because, like you mentioned earlier, this is one of the key movies that Disney has. Like, we're talking, like, when you think of Disney, Belle would probably trump Mickey Mouse these days, or at least the Beauty and the Beast.
No.
In some ways, yeah.
Really?
Well, what Mickey Mouse movie have you seen recently? Name one.
Mickey and the Beast?
Shut up. But no, I mean, even though Mickey Mouse still is the visual representation of what Disney is, I think Disney's smart enough to rebrand stuff. That's why the Princess Lines has been so dominant in the stores. And you see, like, every... I mean, what is there... Is there a connection between all these princess costume stores, princess parties? Right. Because it's much more self... And I think... reality is Belle epitomizes a certain princess, not like the typical princess, like, say, a Cinderella or maybe a Jasmine, but something which was a woman who was smart, a woman who had one of the first movies that had an independent mind. Like, even though if you look at Little Mermaid, she's still a bit of a spoiled princess. I mean, she's still got away.
It's very true. That's one of the reasons it was set things apart. For 1990... it established a new type of princess.
Absolutely.
For 1990. Now, this is where I would have loved to have had a woman on the podcast to actually sort of wrestle with this question on this one, but we couldn't get one. But which is why I think it's interesting that Belle is different even now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a 2017 Belle and 1990s Belle are actually quite different, which is actually, I mean, that's a great place to go from this. What character changes do you see in the film, and do they change the film? What do you see?
Well, it's interesting you said that Beauty and the Beast of the 90s. I look at even the women protagonists back then. And the only thing that sticks in my mind would be, I don't know if Xena was either 90s or 2000, but Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
She was late 90s.
Late 90s, okay. But Buffy was early 90s. And this was an era where women were kicking butt, like major butt. Now, Disney obviously couldn't do Vampire Slayer they might
do it. Still pre-Vampire Slayer.
It was pre-Vampire.
Because Vampire Slayer... I just saw...
96, was it?
They just celebrated their 20th anniversary, I believe. It might have been 97, 25th. Then. I'll look into that. You
can anyway, as I was talking with my wife, she asked, Derek, how many protagonists in Disney movies are male these days? And I thought, I can't really remember, because I think of...
2003.
Thank you, 2003. So it's a little later.
Still early. Oh, wait a second. That was wrong. I'm sorry. Forget what I'm saying.
Okay, I'm gonna forget what you're saying. But
that was season 7. It was 1997. It was late 90s.
But it was a time when, I think for a lot of my peers, when they were in their early 20s, the women roles in TV and movie were very, very strong. Almost, I won't say defined of men, but just very much strong. I don't need a man at all. Where I found this Belle... she was strong, but there was more a spirit of more compassion and understanding. I don't know if I misread it.
In this Belle. In 2017.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I don't know if it was just Emma Watson's character, but I know that she can be a fiery character, of course, if you've seen other movies. But this one, it was like she seemed, the director wanted her to be a little more, I won't say reserved, that's not the right term, but just not as robust for me personally.
I was just trying to figure out what you meant by robust.
I guess in the character, I mean, when I see her, maybe it's just the direction. I didn't see fire in her eyes.
Ah, okay. I see what you mean.
Because the scene, remember when, the defining scene for me actually in the one of the anime movie is when she faces the mob with Gaston and says, he's not a monster, you're a monster. Mm. And when they did it with this film, it was a one take. There was no emphasis on the monster, just like, he's not a monster, you're a monster. And it's like, oh, it's I still remember in the anime movie, they actually pan close to her face to emphasize, you're a monster, yeah. Gaston.
He's not the monster, you are. Yeah, you're right. Interesting. I had see, in her case, I almost had the opposite feel.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. In the original film, Belle is portrayed, yes, she differs from so many other animated princesses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to your earlier point, I wouldn't argue that Belle is the iconic princess. I would argue that princesses are the iconic princess now.
Okay.
There isn't really one that stands out, I would say, other than Elsa. Let's be serious.
Elsa?
And Carrie Fisher, she counts now.
Yes, but she does. Carrying a gun and shooting at those, yes, Imperial's troops.
It's true. But you see, it's interesting because the princess line is almost bigger than any individual princess nowadays, yeah. I would say. Yeah. But Belle was different. She was educated.
Yes.
She was intelligent. And yes, she was a Spitfire. But when you watch her character throughout the film, I would argue that she, in some ways she's far more complicit.
Really?
Yeah, because there are some subtle differences.
Hmm.
For example, when she switches places with her father in the animated film, I believe...
You know what?
She doesn't push him out of the... She doesn't push him out
she
of
She runs in, slams the door to make her the prisoner. She, in the 2017, she goes
That's
in...
That's what she does now.
Yes.
But what does she do in 1990?
She basically goes... In 1990 is when he goes to the beast, is like, take me, and like...
Doesn't agreement. He throws her in the prison.
Well, she says, done. So he grabs the father, throws it out... And she's there saying, I need a chance to say goodbye.
Yes, but she doesn't go in to say goodbye and throw him out.
Yes, right.
And what's the first thing she does in 2017? She tries to escape from the window. Yes. She starts planning. Yeah. There seems to be much more of a resistance.
That's true.
There's a stronger level of resistance to the situation with the Beast. Because as much as I love the original film, she goes along with it. Awfully quickly. And even though she is...
I blame the dad. The dad in the 90s movie, he was a dum-dum head. He was a dum-dum head.
Oh, it's
come on.
It's true. Kevin Klein brings a much, much deeper sense of education.
Yes.
It. Now, something else I will say about Belle in this one, too. She uses that education more.
True that.
She hasn't just read a lot of books. Not only that, they have that scene where she's actually teaching another child to read.
That is true.
There's sort of an external, I understand that the world is bigger than this, and I want you all to understand that the world is bigger than this.
Now, do you think that also has to... I'm thinking about nowadays the social media, and we're connecting this to the world.
Hmm.
Back in the 90s, I think we had CD players, maybe?
Possibly. We did have CD players in 1990. Derek, we're not that old, man.
Actually, we are pretty old. Let's face it, we're old.
That's touche.
No, but yeah. I'm thinking how perception of women, what does it mean to be a strong woman in the 90s?
That's what I'm saying,
yeah.
And that's what I'm getting at. Because okay. To be a strong woman in 1990 in a media perception is to be educated and confident.
Mm-hmm.
To be a strong woman in 2017, and as two men... Here we are discussing what it means, but
we're feminists. Trust us, we are. My wife has a
job.
No, hey.
But 2017, it looks different because it's not just about being confident and educated. It's also about let's help other people understand that there's a sense of equality.
You know, what I find very interesting.
Mm.
Since we're talking about movies from like 90s, early 2000s, sure. Here, how popular the Twilight series was in their depiction of Bella.
Yep.
Which is interesting to Bella and stuff like that. Beautiful. But in the Twilight movies...
Oh, she's completely complicit.
She's, like, she's like terrible. She's, like, she's throwing herself on the male protagonist, and I need your help, until the very last movie. But it's, like, there's these waves going on where it's, like, we see Belle in the 90s, and she's a little complicit. Then we have Bella from Twilight, and very complicit. But then you also have the Lord of the Ring movies, and the women were very strong. So it's weird how the producers or the people who are financing movies, what they want these particular male and female characters, what they are supposed to depict.
Yeah, and the audience is different too, yes. Right? That's the interesting thing is when you look at the original Beauty and the Beast, the market is 10-year-old girls.
Yes.
And so what are they communicating to those young women is saying, we want you to be educated, we want you to be wise. But be sweet, be kind, you know? And what I really liked about the difference between Belle now is that she's still sweet and she's still very well educated, but she's trying to pass that on and she's trying to help other people to see the differences that there can be. And it, there's that scene where she's teaching the little girl, and somebody says, "You're teaching a girl to read."
I think it's their daughter. I think it's supposed to be like they were kind of concerned about.
Oh, about that man's daughter.
Yeah, that daughter.
That's
right. It's like, what are you doing? You're making my daughter think? Like, what a horrific thing. But then it's interesting how, in the movie of the 90s, how Gaston talk about, you know, the fool I've been thinking, a dangerous thing.
Dangerous pastime? I know.
And it's like, it's interesting how, even though we laugh at it, to have an independent mind and thinking critically, for many people, they still see it as a threat.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I think the movie, in a good way, bridged the fact that we don't want people, whether men or women, simply just to be brainless, like, minions.
No.
And just do, actually think, make a difference, but don't just be passive in it. So in some ways, I did like the movie in that, the new 2017 movie in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, one of the things that she says when she goes to the first library, the huge difference in the two libraries, the first library in the animated film has probably about 100 books.
Yes.
This one has 6.
Yes.
And she says, "Your library makes our world look small."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that's wonderful. Now, again, that can be a 2017 thing with the infestation of the internet and the use of the internet and all this, the global idea. But that also shows that, you know, we have to be able to break out of this cycle. That's a very key change. Mm-hmm. What are there other changes that you see? What other characters? Of course, Belle being the center.
The Beast had more humor. I found the Beast
a little bit more humor.
A little
more human.
Remember how I talked about the Roman Juliet? Like, just the way he...
Those
little touches, which made it, obviously, he's more relatable that way, versus the animated Beast was a little... It was interesting, because when you look at the animated Beast, the transition from being a monster, a feral creature, into someone who was more civil, because you're right, it was an 88-minute movie, it had to be very, very quick. So it almost seemed unnatural, this transition, whereas this one, because of the added time, they were able to make a more organic change, which I thought, I like that more because it's more relatable. But again, because of my bias to the 88-minute movie, I knew in my mind, this is how it should be. So people can say, yeah, that's how he changed. This is actually a more realistic depiction of what's changed. But because of my, perhaps, adherence to the 88-minute 90s movie, I thought, well, this is too long. It's taking too much time.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that. I could have done without the scene with the book. I thought the book was sort of introduced. Much of the new film is based on backstory, which is interesting, too, because, see, when you think about that, backstory changes the view of a character.
Mm-hmm.
Changes the view of a character. So now with the Beast, we now understand that he had a cruel father and his mother died.
Yes.
Which we never knew before. So because he had a cruel father, we understand that he's been shaped this way. He's not just a selfish jerk, which is what he is in the original movie. He's just a very selfish man. But he becomes privileged and almost one-percented, if you will, where and I think they actually say that they make their money on the backs of the people in the town.
And I found it interesting, the first sequence in the animated movie, when you're getting the backstory.
Sorry. Didn't say that.
When you look at the animated movie, they talk about there was a prince who was wealthy. And it was a stained glass kind of story. If for those who've never seen the animated movie, maybe you could watch it too. It'd be helpful.
Absolutely.
But the depiction and backstory of his is done by a stained glass storytelling. Where this one, they actually decided to do a live, opulent party with the garb, everything. And it was incredible. I mean, I can only imagine, like, that one scene alone probably for, 5 minutes cost a good $10 million because the set, the costumes was over the top. And what I would like to have maybe possibly seen is that the town, the small village, was actually poorer. What if it was really – if all his money was made on the backs of people, imagine the town was more broken, more destitute.
Derek, you want this to get dark. You want this to go all Dickens?
You know,
is that what you're saying?
It was the best of times. I think one of the things is when you watch, and you mentioned it, when you watch The Jungle Book, from the anime to John Favreau's depiction, I mean, it was dark.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe it's just my adult cynicism of the world. And probably if you had that darkness in the new Beauty and the Beast, it'd probably make only $150 million, not $170 million. But the thing is, it's just I have to always remember, and again, talking, it's really made for a certain clientele with kids who are going to go, and if I want to see Dark, and I still yet to see Logan, and I did see John Wick 2, it's made for an audience who is older.
That's right.
So that's why it's good when I do this podcast, it reminds me, oh yeah, maybe I should watch it again, to evaluate from a family view, family thing.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was interesting is that in all this effort to give backstory, they gave it to Belle.
Mm-hmm.
They gave it to the Beast.
Yes.
They gave it to a little bit to, not so much to LeFou, but they fleshed out LeFou.
Yeah.
They gave it to Belle's father. They gave nothing more to Gaston.
Oh, Gaston. Oh,
Gaston
no.
still has no backstory, no. And they made him darker by, you know, him actually trying to kill Belle's father in the film, which he doesn't do in the animated movie. It was an interesting switch.
Well, it was interesting how Gaston, too, we knew from the first movie, in a comedic sense, I mean, he's a narcissist, right?
Yeah.
He only cares about himself. But I still, spoiler alert, when it came down to the end battle back at the Beast's castle, and LeFou's pinned down, and says, help me. And Gaston says, I gotta be a hero. I'm gonna leave you. Don't care.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, that's not even like that nice guy kind of dark. That's a bad guy dark, where this person who stood with you all this time is in danger of losing his life, and you just leave.
Yeah.
Just leave. I thought,
that's true.
Wow. Wow. Also, interesting how the difference is of how Gaston did not do hand-to-hand combat. Like in the animated movie at the very end, he used a gun to shoot the Beast in the back.
See, I thought that was, although it's darker, it's also much cleaner.
It is cleaner.
I thought that was much more sanitized for the kids because you don't see a gunshot.
No, no, no.
It's very different than taking a blade and shoving it into someone's back,
which
is what they did in the animated film. He's actually holding it at some point, I think, isn't he?
He slips, and that's when he falls. Yeah. But I just felt like this one made Gaston darker because he's from a distance. So he is basically chicken shooting Beast. I mean, that guy has no scruples about anything. He's
true.
It's like, wow.
What do you think about there was a huge controversy, of course.
About how he has homosexual tendencies?
Yeah.
I honestly didn't care. Listen, I mean, when you go to the 90s movie, I mean, there was still, like, the time when the dresser, remember how during the attack in the castle, grabs one of the people from the town, pulls him inside, and comes out as a drag queen, or less dressed in
front of him.
And that's
a
common thing. But in this movie, when that happens, and three guys are put out, two of them are horrified the dressed as women, and one guy is like, I'm happy. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I know I can see for some people who are from more conservative, perhaps, right-wing, perhaps, the sensibilities, they'll find that kind of offensive. Like, why would you even think about depicting LeFou and other characters like a homosexual lifestyle as funny or acceptable? And I thought, for me, I just thought it's just part of the story. But maybe I've changed. I don't know. But I wasn't bothered by it.
No, and I think that Disney was smart by releasing or by starting the controversy probably 2 weeks ago.
Mm.
Because, first of all, it got people talking. Now, yes, there were people that there was some theater, and I think it was in Atlanta or something, that refused to show it.
Well, wow.
They missed out on like $80 million or something.
Wow.
I don't know what they, but it's much ado about nothing. But one of the things I thought about in a film like this, you talk about changes, is a much deeper sense of representation.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, that was the most multicultural, peasant 1800s French village I've ever seen in my entire life,
even in itself. Even in the first scene with the big party, it's like, it's multi-ethnic. I'm like, this is great.
It was fine. And I think there's representation telling people's stories. I think it's fine. And it's funny because this is where films are going.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you talk about conservative mindset, people need to hear their stories told, so I didn't have an issue with it, and it's still true to what the story is.
It is,
and I didn't have a problem with that.
I'm glad they had Josh Gad because I still like Josh Gad.
I like Josh Gad.
He's a funny guy, man. His comedic timing is great. He's just character personality that's like very likable. Honestly,
you know what I will say. You know what I will say. This is, if I want them to be able to tell new stories and create new characters, I think that you lose something when you change a character that has been created a certain way and you want to emulate that. If you're not seeking to emulate it, you know, in some ways, Ghostbusters had the same problem. I was talking when we did the podcast on it, actually.
Right.
I think it was Jeffrey Overstreet made a great point. And his issue with Ghostbusters wasn't that they had women Ghostbusters. It was that they had women playing the boys' roles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tell great stories about, now, I guess they were not the same characters. So that's something. But tell great stories about new characters that lets you do that.
Well, here's the interesting, now that we talk about this, like old stories and new stories. I think Disney knew, I'm going to be honest, I think it could have been a terrible cast and they would have made tons of money. Why? Because the people going to this movie are nostalgic about the
90s. Absolutely.
I mean, thankfully they decided to get a great cast, but I think what I see a trend is people don't want to tell new stories from a financial standpoint. They want to go back to the nostalgic things and make a lot of money because, hey, everyone's familiar with this story. I mean, is there no surprise that Mulan is in production to be a live action movie? What was also another Disney, Mulan, something else? I can't remember. But it's just, basically, it's now we're like, are we going to sacrifice originality and creativity for the sake of just making more money? Because,
yeah, Disney is making their making money hand over fist by not doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, Star Wars in and of itself
comes with
expectations.
Yeah.
They did well with Rogue One.
Yes.
And I liked what was the new one? I can't think of the name. Episode 7.
Oh, Force Awakens.
Force Awakens a lot. But Force Awakens was a retelling of an old story.
Absolutely.
That's what they went for.
Absolutely.
Marvel is retelling of comic books that have that history. And what's the number one criticism of most of them is, that's not the way it was in the comics.
Right.
You know, it's nostalgia, nostalgia, nostalgia. And they're making money hand over fist in doing it. You're absolutely right. Nostalgia is key to their marketing strategy.
Absolutely. I still remember when I watched The Matrix back in 98.
Which they're bringing back, by the way.
No way.
Warner Brothers.
Oh, my gosh.
With anyway. The young Morpheus. Go ahead.
Anyway. But I still remember, I mean, not even for the camera technique, but the whole aspect of, like, all the stories. Now, understandably, there was Eastern mysticism they touched upon, Christianity, all these things they put in, but it was different. It wasn't like a retelling of a story we've known before, and I thought, this is kind of cool. Like, they took things, and I would like to see if I, as a critic and watching movies a lot, I don't mind using older genres and stuff like that, but just weave it into something new.
I agree.
Just, like... But at the same time, if you're going to do something new, and this is what happened with the second and third Matrix movie. Apparently, the Wachowski brothers, well, now they're... Well, anyway.
The Wachowskis.
The Wachowskis, thank you. The Wachowskis were too concerned about how to market it a little better that some of the storytelling got kind of lost.
Right.
And I thought that's a shame because they had an amazing platform working with the first Matrix. Hmm. And when Revolutions and Reloaded came out, I was quite disappointed.
Well, the third one... I like the second one. The third one has no story.
Mm.
I see what you're saying. And this is... You need to be able to take risks.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about these Disney live-action movies is they're literally giving you exactly what you had before.
You know it's going to be a happy ending. You know that there's going to be arc of where the tension is, but you know there's going to be a resolution, and everyone's happy when you put down your... How much money you put down for tickets these days, because they're expensive.
Oh, I know. Well, that's... And that plays into it, too.
Yeah.
In some ways, you can't fault them.
No.
You know, they talk about the gap between money-making and the Oscars, and there's a big reason, because Beauty and the Beast is not going to be nominated for Best Picture this year. But... It's going to make more money than half the movies that are made this year because people are looking for that. But whatever wins Best Picture in 2018, people, you know, it may have made $50 million in the box office if it's lucky.
I know that Beauty and the Beast will win an Oscar and it'll be for probably costume design or special effects, probably.
Oh, yeah. And maybe best song because, of course, they do have new songs. Which, talking about changes, I was so excited when I realized this. Do you realize in this film... This may be the first Disney animated film, definitely since Hunchback, where the guy gets the power ballad.
Mm.
Because Beast's new song is the new Let It Go. Now, ironically, it isn't nearly as catchy as Let It Go or anything like that. Yeah. I can't even remember what the song is. But I remember sitting there loving it.
Yeah.
And it's the first male power ballad that I've heard in a song in 20 years.
You're talking about when the Beast is basically reflecting on...
Yes.
The stuff. But here's my criticism of that.
I already said I liked it. You can't criticize
it. I can criticize it. I am not. I don't care. Dan, what's the actor's
name? Dan Stevens.
Dan Stevens. I like his voice. But that song was for Josh Groban. Like, at the end, when it was...
Right, okay.
That song, when Josh sang it, was like, wow, that sounds amazing. And that's my criticism because... When you have Josh Groban's voice, I mean, it's almost like you would watch Josh Groban singing it and just be pondering because Josh Groban's vocals, let me tell you, His vocals, Dan,
yeah,
good
but you
job.
You can't do that now. You can't
I know
do
you can't. I know you can't. But like when you hear that song, you're almost like that song was written for Josh Groban. It was written so written because when you heard it at the end, I was like, oh man, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I love that song. It's absolutely stunning.
That would be my only criticism because Dan and like a lot of actors, they don't have the singing chops for some of these really quite hard technical songs to do well.
It's true. It's true.
So that's the only thing. But I agree with you. I think it's kind of cool that there was a male power ballad to be the main song.
It's always either a villain song or a funny song that the guy sings. That you know the Let It Go model has been their model for 20 years. You know when it's coming. And when we sat there, that was the first thing that struck me. Was this is a absolutely wonderful song.
Yeah.
And the Beast is singing it. Like this is you just didn't expect it coming. But, you know, I want to go back to something you talked about. We talked about nostalgia. What does it mean for a story to be timeless? Can a story change and that still be applicable? What does it mean to be a timeless
story? You know what? Unless you have a story that is like, Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham. I am Sam. Sam I am where the whole...
Whoa. Wait a minute. Tale is old as time.
Sam I am. I like green eggs and ham. Everyone will have their take because it's almost like if you ask us, hey, what was it like to have Christmas time as a child? We might be able to give how we felt, but can we give an actual accurate step-by-step of what it was like to be a child as a five-year-old? And I think sometimes stories, I think there is a main thread of what we feel. When we want to communicate a main how we feel is to the audience we're talking to. And I have in this watch this movie, I'm watching a lot of other movies, it made me realize that I think the filmmakers or storytellers are trying to convey how they feel, but the story itself will not be exactly the same.
Hmm.
So, I mean, can there be a story that is timeless? I mean, we can look at the gospel story, we can look at other stories. But even if we look at, say, the gospel stories, since we're talking about the four gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, they have a story that's the same, but it's not exactly the same. So, yes and no to the answer. Can it be timeless? Yes and no.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about because there are so many films that if you watch them, you say, well, that isn't timeless. Well, how do you know? I don't know. It just doesn't feel that way. You know,
The Fast and Furious isn't timeless? Tokyo Drift isn't timeless? Come on, Steve. I like the film, by the way. Except for the main character. I didn't like him. Donkey Kong, DK, what?
Cars as fast as guns. Men as bald. Anyway. But you know what? It's funny. I remember when King's Speech won Best Picture at the Oscars. And I remember being so upset because Social Network, I thought, was a far more engaging film. And my argument was the Social Network was a moment in time movie. Like, that movie felt like it had to happen today.
Yep.
And it was rooted in that moment.
Yep.
And it was a real opportunity for the Oscars to say they're not irrelevant.
Right.
So they went with more of a period piece. And I think for a story to be timeless, I think it's often rooted in a time that isn't ours.
Mm.
But I think as you were talking there, one of the things that made me think of it too is that it has to be rooted more in the meaning and the character journey than in the specifics of the time.
Right.
So Beauty and the Beast takes place in whatever century it is.
21st century? Isn't that?
Yeah. Paris in 1997.
Where's our cell phones? Come on.
That's right. that mirror is actually hooked up to the local Wi-Fi. And the original line is "Google me the girl."
Google me the girl.
And there were some issues with that in the original.
Or just Snapchat
well.
It. Snapchat me.
Snapchat the beast. Look, there's a baker on his phone, like always.
Where's my order? I hate when there's no Wi-Fi in this bakery, stupid town. Oh, only three bars? Come on.
That was the first Starbucks. Not many people know that.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, a film like... the film like that is really about the story of the relationship.
Yes.
Which I think is sweeps you up in the music and all those things.
Yes.
Which I think is, when they say a tale as old as time, what they're talking about is the love and the relationship between
them. Isn't it interesting that in the movie, the new movie, 2017, they mentioned the other love movie that is timeless? Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, that's right. One. It was one of, like, sliding things. Of all the stories, they add in the other love story, which, if you've never read Romeo and Juliet, it doesn't quite end as happily as Beauty and the Beast. Not quite. And even if you watch Baz Luhrmann's...
No spoilers.
If you watch Baz Luhrmann's version, the end is still the same. It's not a happy love story ending. But it's interesting how they just kind of... Whoever wrote the script for that, they had to add that in as almost a little thing. So it's, hey, Beauty and the Beast, for one generation, is their timeless love story. And for another one, it's like, who are understanding stuff, Romeo and Juliet.
Sure.
Is another love, absolutely, timeless love story.
Yeah, you're right, actually. That's a fascinating one. Because they reference a couple of Shakespearean plays in that.
Yeah.
And so this idea of being timeless, I like that you brought in the gospel, because as a pastor, I obviously that's my key focus, is scripture being more of a timeless story. And the meta-narrative and all those things.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the reasons we see it popping up in so many other stories, is we see the influence that the reality of scripture, which of course I believe is reality, it takes into those things. Now, I'm not trying to make Beauty and the Beast a gospel
beast
narrative.
Is Jesus. but then
he
again...
He gives his life! There it is!
A lot of audience who want a happy ending like redemptive stories. They like seeing a character who's flawed, or you're starting out at a place where it's broken, and to have a narrative that finally brings the audience and the characters to a place where there's wholeness. Yeah. Thank you very much. And I think for many people, that's why these stories, like, say, Beauty and the Beast, despite what you might think of the music or whatever, the sense of there's a resolution at the end.
Hmm.
And, like, for those, again, spoiler, the Beast does change back to a human being. The audience likes to see a redemptive story and to see how Beast not only comes back, again, spoiler, comes back to life after being killed, but the sense of his act of selflessness redeems the entire kingdom.
Yes,
it redeems everyone. Everyone goes back. Because it's interesting, because in the animated movie, the supporting characters in the castle don't die. They don't go back to the state of...
You're right.
In this one, because the Enchantress, who, spoiler alert, was always with him all the time...
You don't have to keep saying spoiler alert.
Okay.
We said that there were spoilers.
I know, I just like saying that.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler. Derek might say spoiler alert again before the...
What? But when the Enchantress decides to grant life back to the Beast, everyone goes back, including the villagers who lost their memories.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that before, is that the nature of love in a story like this actually redeems the entire nation.
Entire.
Which, in the original, sure, they all change back. But there is a greater sense of impact to this one story of redemption that I hadn't considered. I'm glad you said that, because those villagers have lost their lives, and when they're in the castle, one of them actually says, "I feel like I've been here before, but I don't understand why." And there is that. Some of them, families have been separated by, you know, by this curse.
Miss Potts and Mr. Potts finally come back together.
Oh, Mr. Potts. Oh. Although, yeah, did you...
Kevin Kline? Did you see the
weird... Yeah, I thought Mrs. Potts was going to hook
She was hitting on Kevin Kline. I said, I was like, aw, that last scene is like,
It made me uncomfortable.
I was like, are you looking at each other?
Side note, it's amazing how tone of voice can shift... the line exactly. For example, opening song, when he says, "Bonjour, madame," and she says, "How is your wife?" How did they manage to, just by changing the way she said it, suggest that he's having an affair with this woman?
It's like,
all right, anyway. How is your wife? Yes. Bonjour. Anyway, yeah. No, that's it. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, about the love, for sure. What relationship do you see in a film like this between love and freedom? Because there very much is one. Since we're talking about the redemptive nature of love, how do you see that relationship playing out?
If you watch the movie, and Belle had numerous opportunities, she wanted to escape. She told her dad, "I'm going to escape," but she didn't. She stayed. And even with the blankets tied in a rope out the window, it's like she's ready to run. And I think for her, even though the Beast demanded her to stay and she agreed to stay, there was never any sense of harsh penalties. Like, if you leave, I'm going to kill you. Just like, you got to stay. Mm. That's your verbal agreement. So in a way, you knew it was setting up for, like, she
was bound to be doing something bigger. And the freedom I saw in the relationship is that even though all his servants were telling the Beast, oh, maybe it's the one and stuff like that, she still decided to get to know him. I mean, after, I can imagine if I was sitting in a room and I was a prisoner and someone, my captor comes and smashes the door and says, you better have dinner with me. No, I'm never having dinner with you. But the way they filmed, I felt that it wasn't so terrible that they closed all doors. There was still an opening for maybe there was a possibility. And fortunately, maybe in the story too, it was like the original anime movie. The servants had reminded, he's not so bad. And in this movie, because of the backstory, it helps flesh a lot. Out. Yes.
You know what I thought was an interesting line, and I don't think it's in the movie. Sorry, I don't think it's in the animated movie, but I could be wrong on this. Correct me if I'm wrong. When they're standing out on the balcony and he confesses his feelings, which I don't think he does in the animated film. Is there? There's no scene after.
No, it doesn't. After
the dance.
No.
But he says to her, could you be happy here? Because he makes a comment and he says, you wouldn't be interested in a beast like me. And she says, oh, I'm not so sure about that. And then he says, could you be happy here? And she says, can one be truly happy if not free?
He does say in the first movie, he says, Belle, are you happy? Yes. And then he says, what's wrong? And then she says,
I miss my father. They do get to the father part in this, and that's what causes her to leave, but they don't get the line in the original one.
No.
Can one be truly happy if not?
No, that line is totally 2017.
Which I loved. I love that because that to me was a very honest and modern look at what love is. And it's funny, you know, as pastor, one of the things that people criticize scripture for is they say, well, if God truly loved us, he would have not brought or allowed evil to be in the world.
Oh man, here we go to the deep theological,
deep theology here.
Oh no, love, freedom, like, can one really be loved if every decision is made for them and they have no option?
Well, and you've got the garden.
Of course.
And in the garden you've got the tree and he says don't eat it, and people always say, well, if he really loved humanity, he wouldn't have put the tree in the garden, and that story makes no sense. But if it's not there, there's no option to spurn love.
For sure.
There has to be an element of freedom for love to be a true relationship. And of course, as a pastor, I see that the deepest one being a relationship with God.
Yeah.
And love in its fullness is love that is chosen. Why don't we talk about the love aspect? You and I can get real emotional and hold each other if we want.
Oh, well, that would be lovely.
I know.
That would be lovely.
Barely even friends. Never mind.
Pause.
But the film called Beauty and the Beast, obviously, and both come into play within the story. So what does it mean to be a beauty in the film, and what does it mean to be a beast? How does that play in?
Well,
you can pick one and start with
it.
We'll
do beauty first. And Emma Watson is not hard in the eyes, first of all. I don't find she's hard in the
eyes. Beautiful. She's a beautiful young woman.
And it'd be interesting.
You're creepy. No, I'm kidding.
It would be interesting if they had someone who's not a prototypical thin, waif, like pretty person to act as Belle. Because obviously you want someone who was a close representation of the 90s movie. I mean, Emma Watson is a great actress. It was just interesting because really it was not her external beauty, and I think that's the whole point of the movie. It's not external beauty that caused one to be beautiful. She was considerate. She was kind. She fought for things that were right. She didn't, like, ingest things. And so that is what conveyed for beauty. In the Beast part, we saw both in Gaston and in the Prince, who turned to the Beast, they were selfish. In fact, Gaston's selfishness was driven by narcissist behavior to the point that he's willing to kill things just so that he feels he's on the top rung of the ladder. So if we look at beastly attributes in that way, we're looking at how the film is trying to, we're talking like the guy they picked for Gaston. He's a good looking guy. He's a guy from the Dracula movie.
Luke Evans.
He's not a hard, I mean, he's a good looking guy too. So it's interesting where they get these good looking guys, but you put them in these roles, and the storyline, I guess, is you could be a book, but the cover is beautiful, but inside it's kind of mired in some problems.
Yeah, and certainly that's where they go with the whole Beast storyline as well. It is interesting to see how Shrek shapes and plays with this story, and I go back to the original one because there's only one worth talking about. But
yes,
the original one took that and flipped it on its ear, which was an interesting transition in storytelling, especially animated storytelling, because it really was the first one to take the beauty and make her a quote-unquote beast.
Right.
You know, to truly say the issue isn't the ogre. I mean, the issue is this outdated sense of beauty. It is interesting in some ways that the beast, do we even actually know his name? Do they say his name?
He's anyway, the prince. He's
the prince. Becomes that sort of ideal sense of the beginning. But they do make a real sense of expressing that humility, and the real change is his heart.
Yeah.
Yes, he physically, because her love for him is beyond his physicality anyway. But it is interesting that the beauty idea is such an important factor. And I think this goes into the idea of the Disney princesses. We talk about that. And, you know, this online campaign that happened a few months ago after Carrie Fisher died to officially make her a Disney princess.
Yes.
Because she sort of breaks that mold. And even though she is a princess, she doesn't fit into that idea of the princess mold. And in some ways, Disney killed the term princess. Like, I almost think the term princess had been ruined.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think of a princess now, you think of that, or think of that model. And again, we talked about how Belle changed that stereotype.
But here's something interesting that my friend talked about. It's like, whenever you want someone who's not atypically beautiful by the superficial standards, they are often delegated to a comedy role. Something funny.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right.
Because, like, Shrek, it took that whole genre of the beauty being different, beauty inside, but it was still a humorous movie. You look at other films. I think of Melissa McCarthy's character in Spy, where she was, like, if you've never seen Spy, she plays someone who is, like, an analyst, becomes this spy, but it was still comedy. So, yeah, we can see inner beauty inside, but it can't be a serious movie where the person who is often maybe not quoted as beautiful be a serious movie. It's got to be something funny. And that's something that one of my friends said, I thought about it, it's true. There's rarely any serious movies where two protagonists who are visually not appealing end up being, like, seriously, oh, this is great.
Yeah, it is interesting that still continues to be the story. We're told that it's different, but it continues to be that way.
Because if you look at the animated movie, Belle's dad, he was, like, a bit of a dodo head. Like, even his adventure.
He is.
But he's round. He's kind of like...
Yeah, you're right.
He has all the features of a comedic anime thing. And the people who were the quote-unquote beautiful people, even like how the beast was drawn, it was like serious. And when he transformed to a human being again, it was a serious looking thing. It was just, there's something lacking in terms of comic things. This is when you're beautiful, it's gonna be serious. This is when we're being serious about this stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually. I hadn't really thought about those visual representations as well, but you're absolutely right. There is a deeper sense of stereotype, but just inherently culturally. Mm-hmm. Whereas at the time, it wouldn't have been noticed.
Yeah.
But now we look back and we say, my gosh, I hadn't thought of that. Like Peter Pan, you look back at Peter Pan, you're like, dude.
Because I even think of Cars, because I know that a lot of people go, oh, Cars. But Lightning McQueen was kind of the cool sports car, the first one. And then the girlfriend was the Porsche. And
Mater's the comedy, and he's broken into this old, broken down jalopy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt
you. Oh, no, that's fine.
You're absolutely right. I'm thinking of this for the first time. And it is interesting, too, that with Kevin Kline playing the role of the father, he's now more respected as well.
Right.
He's more of a respectable character. Though LeFou also, I would say, by the end of the film, doesn't play LeFou.
No.
He is not the fool.
Yes.
He is transformed. His character is not simply the foolish one.
Correct.
There is, again, going back to that sense of wholeness, there is that sort of releasing of who he is.
But imagine if we had Chris Evans play LeFou.
Chris Evans or Luke Evans?
We'll take both.
Captain America playing LeFou? Yeah, you're right. You're right.
I mean, you would never have someone who's bigger than Gaston play LeFou. You have someone who's... Because Josh Gad is not exactly the slimmest guy. He's kind of round. He has the features of, like, what you see in a lot of comedic characters. They're
a
little heavier.
You're right.
Or shorter. Or, like, it's never the ideal 6'2", perfect broad, or silhouette of a Coke bottle. None of that. It's got to be rounder or shorter or something that's not handsome, pretty.
In some ways, I think we're starting to move out of that because awareness is starting to build. But I also think we don't understand where we need to go yet. I think we need to know. I think we know where we want to go.
Yeah.
But we don't know how to get there as a culture.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Beauty and the Beast, it's going to be Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
It's going to be that. And she has to have the yellow dress and he has to have the blue tux. And there are certain expectations that go with it. It is interesting to see how the nature of beauty in some ways has shifted, but in some ways has not.
Yeah. I just thought of, I don't know if anyone has ever watched, but the Once Upon a Time, their Disney thing. Look at the characters. If you're not familiar with the characters, the ones who are the main characters are still fairly good looking. And again, the comic people are those who are dwarfs or those who are look kind of odd and stuff like that. But the main serious characters are still good looking.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about the relationship between message and medium, because on a message standpoint, it's a very good message.
Very good message.
Very good message.
Very, very good message.
And actually, you know, as a pastor, this idea of not just looking at this, looking beyond our stereotypes of people, and I wouldn't say just looking beyond the skin, because I don't think that we need to do that as a culture. I think Zootopia tried to go beyond that, and it didn't. Because one of the things I think we need to celebrate our differences. But, you know, when we see how God made us and created us, and so many times we get bogged down by those external things rather than seeing who God created us to be, that true beauty lies in that. And the film does talk about not getting bogged down by those things. It does. And we talk about Gaston being narcissistic, and Gaston is actually far more vicious than the Beast in this film, as we sort of touched on. But even though we understand that's the message, in some way the film can get bogged down by its own cultural stereotypes that it establishes.
Yes.
And so it's a fascinating thing. And that's not to take away, you know, somebody sitting there saying, but, you know, I just really like the music and I haven't put that, you know, that's fine. But there, when you're thinking about it in a cultural level, there is that challenge that still remains, which
absolutely.
Is,
you know. Absolutely. As much as we like to think Beauty and the Beast is all inside, the truth, if we are brutally honest, is how someone looks. Already we are hardwired to think if someone's beautiful, we have a face of how it should look.
Yeah,
how
exactly.
body should look. We would like the ideal again. And for those who are listening, thinking, no, I'm not. I don't judge people by their character. You know what? I mean, don't judge people by their looks. They like character. But I, in my perspective, it's still the looks first is what sets the impression of what still is beautiful and what is beastly.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. And again, the film does deal with that in some level, but he's just as much of a monster in the way he deals with people. When it talks about him being a beast, it talks about him, like you said, showing that backstory, talks about him being a beast before he becomes a physical beast.
Now, here's something interesting, and I know that time is short for me, so I got to talk real quickly. What if we had a backstory of Gaston where he was a tragic hero? Would you hate him?
Gosh, it disturbs me to know your story.
because in the movie, we got a bit of a glimpse of people's backstories, except for Gaston. You mentioned that to me earlier, but if we had a backstory where actually he was an orphan or he was beaten or something terrible, it would cause him to be this vengeful person, would we hate this character or would we more sympathize with him?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There would be a different experience of him for sure. And I think that Gaston, you know, when you... I can't believe it. We're comparing this film to everything. But when you look at The Dark Knight...
Oh, you're already there? That's awesome.
When you look at The Dark Knight and the way that Christopher Nolan decided to portray the Joker...
Absolutely.
When he talks about Heath Ledger's Joker, the way they wrote him was a quote-unquote force of nature. Mm-hmm. That is what he described the Joker as a force of nature. They shift his backstory. You never know who his backstory is, so it's easy to hate him, even though he's charismatic and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we're always fascinated by the Joker. That's not what I'm talking about. But because you don't know his backstory, it is easier to see him as the epitome of
evil. Absolutely.
And we're in that culture now where backstory does shift our understanding of the nature of evil, and even that, you know, when we talk about our theology and we talk about the nature of evil, we talk about how... We talk about when people are broken because we look at the whole person and we say, yes, but we struggle with the idea of sin in some ways, because when we talk about darkness, when you put a backstory in, does it change how we understand how that person is, it certainly changes the way we relate to them.
Absolutely.
So the nature of evil has shifted. By keeping Gaston to having no backstory, it's far easier to hate him.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
All you need is a story in there about how the Beast ran his family out of town or something like that, even. Not even that his father was beaten, but that somehow this Beast...
You'd have a trilogy of movies because you want to feel that Gaston needs avenging.
That's it's right. Like, exactly. Exactly. It's or fascinating.
And the thing is, I think for a story like Beauty and the Beast, you want, because it is a family film directed, you don't want to have too many complexities hitting each other, or else it becomes a Netflix series, which is not a bad thing in itself if you can elaborate stuff. But if you want to keep within a two-hour movie, you have to establish good is good, bad is bad, this is what we have, the end. So,
well, look at Maleficent.
Oh, I love Maleficent.
Maleficent, though, takes that character, which does. I love, and Wicked, which I both love, both things. Wicked is like the gold standard of modern musicals, but those take that villainous character that has always been the clear-cut villain,
yes,
and tells you how they got there, absolutely, and it reshapes entirely the story. Entirely.
So that's why I think the people who were creating the Beauty and the Beast were very clear that they wanted Gaston to be the person to hate. You don't want to second guess them. You don't want to have anything that says it's a motivating factor because of a tragic backstory. This is it, the end. So in a way, it's still, like you said, even though the message of Beauty and the Beast is good, it's a little incomplete because the way it depicts true beastliness, we don't know why. And I think for a person like you and I, we understand why they do that, but it really challenges what it means to be a beast. Like,
yeah, well, it's the nature of good and evil. I mean, we know what it means. The film is very clear on what it means to be good.
Oh, yes.
And actually, I appreciate that there's still clear lines between good and evil in a film like this. I very much do appreciate that. And while I like the complexities, I love the complexities, it does make a film like this easier to digest
in so
many ways.
It does.
You're right about the audience when you talked about that before. Because the nature of evil still is that which is against hatred, or not against hatred, against love, against sacrifice, selfishness. Well, I guess hatred is for selfishness, not against it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, again, the Beast could be hated, but we start to see that break, and there's that humility that starts to come through by the end.
That's interesting. The whole thing of the Maleficent, man, if we had more time, if they used a Beauty and the Beast story where the backstory, you would actually sympathize more with Gaston instead of Belle, and I mean, you could have gone some crazy route.
Copyright Screenfish 2017. Gaston, the film.
Oh, well, I guess we have to come to close.
No, but it would be interesting. You're right. Actually, that is a great place for us to wrap up. I know that you're running out of time, and so are we. So let's do screen it or skip it. Derek, Beauty and the Beast, screen it or skip it?
Screen it, but I, on the whole condition, don't think it's going to be the animated movie. Try and think of it as a movie, even though most people go to it, they will always try to compare it to the 1990s animated movie. Do your best not to, and try to have a clearer mind. Because when I went in there thinking it was going to be the animated movie, I got disappointed because I was making too many references of how it was not that movie.
And yet, sometimes it really hits the notes.
Mm-hmm. It
like,
does.
Be Our Guest could have been a disaster.
Oh my gosh. Oh,
they
yeah.
They nailed it. They nailed the numbers that they had to nail. Yeah. And this, you know, talk about the music and the set design, which we opened with. I mean, they nailed the things they had to nail.
Yes.
They really did. We're talking about the complexities, but for me, it's a screen it. I think you can screen it, and I think you can enjoy it. And I think you should see it in the theater because it is. It's still a sweeping story. And yes, they talk, whether or not it's better than the original, it didn't have to be better than the original.
It's different.
It's different than the original. It gives you what you want, but it also adds some new things in, so be prepared for that.
Yeah.
But my gosh, like, you can still get swept up in it and still have a blast and enjoy it, and it's still good. My thought was, when I saw it, when they released Jungle Book, it was a far easier mark to surpass, and absolutely, they blew it out of the water. Like, I almost don't want to watch the animated version again. They blew it out of the water. This one, the mark was so high, they didn't need to be able to surpass it, which is why I suspect that there's so much the audience score being low, or the audience, not the critic score being low, but I could be wrong. But it did have to at least hit the notes that it needed to hit. And I thought it was wonderful. I really enjoyed it. For me, it's a screen it, and I think that It's worth watching.
But it's not the anime, so please, again, don't think it's going to be an anime movie with all... It's a different beats. It's a longer movie, so it's a slower... Take it like a slower meal, enjoy the road instead of a very fast, under 90 minutes movie.
Yeah, it's true. Absolutely. Derek, thank you so much for
coming
on.
No problem, Steve. It was fun.
I absolutely loved having you on. It's great. And for those of you at home, a couple of things. First of all, a reminder that in the first week of April at the TIFF Bell Lightbox, Imago is hosting an event focusing on the relationship between faith and film. Paul Schrader will be there, wrote films like Raging Bull and has directed a great many wonderful films as well. He will be there, and it's only $65. You can find out about it by going to the Imago website, and you can sign up there, and hopefully you will be able to join us at that event. Also, we will be back in 2 weeks, where we will be talking about the new sci-fi film Life, starring Ryan Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal. As always, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and on Podomatic. If you go to the website, screenfish.net, and you go to the podcast page, you can download Fishing for More, which are small group questions that you can have with the people that you see the film with, so that you can have the conversation with your friends and family as well, and your kids, because you should really talk about this with your kids if you take them to see it as well. But as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish. It's interesting too.
I was talking about dark. You know what's also dark? 3D glasses. I don't like 3D glasses. 3D glasses, yeah. It's like, because
that's all
right. No, but the thing is, it actually puts a dark tint on the stuff. Yeah. And that's why I thought, it should feel lighter. And I'm pretty sure if I watch this without the 3D glasses, it'll feel brighter. And maybe my outlook will be different. But
Well, Derek, I want you to understand that you can at any time watch a film without 3D glasses.
Yes, I know.
Beauty and Six Beasts.